Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning and welcome. We always begin at 9:45 to our distinguished visitors. We are not visitors. This is your place. We are very happy to have, I've invited two special people in addition to the great gentlemen who are going to be addressing us today. And I thought that it's important for us to understand when we talk about collaboration, there are many parts to the whole. There are those that are collaborating directly. There are those that are creating the edifice that allow the collaboration to occur. There are those that are bringing those who support the collaboration and allow it to have wheels and to add to the reputation. We have two really wonderful people. One, you don't have the opportunity to meet very often, but he is rather important. In fact, I do not want to identify who, because we currently have four doctors in this room. I don't know about my class, there are probably several among you too, but there are four who one said, oh, here comes the boss. And it is our dean of the School of Medicine at Northwestern University. It has grown in reputation. I have been asked anonymously by two distinguished doctors who are the coordinators for our course to let you know that Marianne and Diane are superior doctors. And they tell me they do really interesting things. Part of it is the education, and part of it is the simulation lab. And if you'll come on for a minute and talk to us about, you had a strategic plan, and how are you feeling about it? Give me any measurable, or give me anything that you'd like to talk about. Our dear friend, Eric Nielsen.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here and be able to, if you will, host this event in our facilities. You know, I think one of the things that we've learned over the last decade or so is that hospitals and medical schools that get along and get together become learning organizations, and so much of what we do in the hospital and our clinics is translated from the work that we do in the medical school to teach new doctors and to discover new ideas about how health and disease happen and what are the things that we need to do to improve the health of our population, the health of humans. That's really our purpose. And so that learning organization is also part of what we're doing today and what your lecture series is all about. It's about learning. It's about trying to keep up with the rapid changes that are going on in science and medicine. And it's especially important today, since we're on the verge of so many new and exciting things that are going to happen over the next couple of decades. So I'm really delighted that there's such great participation in this event. And I thank you all for supporting this effort. And thank you for being here today. We're really excited as a school to have you with us.
And I want to ask Dr. Nielsen, talk to us about the interplay of public health and private practice. Many of us go to private practitioners, and yet there have been a strong emphasis on public health. And you have unusual vision in this. I remember meeting you a couple years ago with the person head of public health in Washington, and you have a vision about their value of knowing.
Well, thank you. Yes, well, doctors historically were in private practice, and they occasionally formed a group to help cover patients so they could have some time off, and then groups got larger. Today, most of our residents and fellows who are leaving their training are becoming employed physicians, largely of hospitals, as they build out the workforce that's needed to operate the hospital and to make them successful. The evolution of that, in my opinion, is that in another 15 or 20 years, almost no physician will be in private practice. It's unaffordable, and the regulatory environment makes it virtually impossible for them to function. There will be a few, I think. Plastic surgery will probably survive because it's largely a cash practice and doesn't fall so much under all of the regulatory activity. There may be a few others, but it's rapidly consolidating around being employed. And of course, there's a generational difference as you look at older physicians or you look at more mature practices. I'm sure you'll find a lot of doctors who still don't like the idea of being employed, but certainly the new ones that are being minted today are pretty much okay with it. When it comes to public health, it's one of the great new adventures that medical schools and health systems and are really embarking on. Public health separated from medical schools back in the 1920s, and that's because the deans of medical schools felt that public health had no real role in healthcare. And that decision caused schools of public health to be created across the country. And there were a fair number of them, not a large number, and today we haven't seen much growth in that. But what we chose to do here at Feinberg was not to create another school of public health, but to create an Institute for Public Health and Medicine. We call it IFAM. And it allows all of the departments in the medical center to participate in thinking about how preventive medicine, how new ideas and processes for healthcare delivery can be achieved in an environment where our workforce is captured. We're all employees of the health system or of the medical school. And there's strategic power in being able to direct that effort, not only in how we practice medicine, but how we think about the larger issues of protecting public health and improving public health, which is an increasingly important role for health systems today. And medical schools are one of the generators of that information. You're going to hear about some of that in a few minutes.
Any questions?
Yes. Well, concierge doctors, and I assume all of you know what that is. You pay a physician some annual membership fee, and they take care of you year-round as a practice, and that sort of defines the scope of their practice. There is some of that. It mainly is occurring in markets or zip codes where it's affordable. Many people can't afford to participate, so it will have some limit in terms of how big it will get. I don't think it's growing rapidly. Most physicians struggle with whether that's the right way to practice medicine today. Obviously, some patients like that. It's convenient, and it has the access is there. And so we have a little bit of that in Chicago, and maybe some of you participate in it. I don't have a strong opinion about it, but I don't think it's the future. It will always be there, I think, at some level. Yes.
Uh-huh. So you pay for well-being health. What does that look like for us here?
Well, gee, we know that we're all of us are going to get sick someday with something, and I don't think it's physicians failing to do their job that lets people get sick. Our bodies are extremely complicated machines, and they break down for various reasons. It's not usually the doctor's fault. So I think it would be unlikely that the expectation of medical care in the United States would shift in that direction. I kind of think that we're all in this together, and if the population can behave in an increasingly more healthy way, there will be less need for medical care. But in this country, that appetite seems enormous, and I don't think it's entirely because public health is failing, but it is the nature of humans to have their own ideas about how healthy they want to be and what risks they're willing to take in their daily life, and those kind of things are powerful drivers in terms of how resilient we are over our lifetimes. And truth is, the average age in which we are living to as a population is increasing. Now, it's starting to flatten off a little. It's a little hard to imagine it getting too much higher, but for men and women, it's up in the 80s. In some populations, it's a little lower, but those are rather remarkable numbers considering that at the turn of the century in 1900, the average age was 47 when people lived. So we almost doubled it. Yes. Well, it's very vulnerable. Most rural hospitals are small. They're not fully staffed with a complete set of specialty-related doctors. People who live in the rural areas are at some risk for acute events that can't be managed. And that's been a long-term problem in this country. It costs today, to build a new hospital, it costs about $2.5 million per bed. Okay? So if you want to, you know, so that's a huge cost, and most rural communities could not be able to do that very well, and it would be very difficult to staff. The other historic problem, which is no surprise, is that it's hard to get doctors to live in rural communities. They want to raise their families in places that have schools and other kinds of activities, and it's not zero, but it is increasingly difficult to interest people in living in too far away from a small city or a large city. So I think it is a vulnerable area of the population, and of course, increasingly, our population is migrating towards larger cities. Maybe part of it is for that reason.
So as you can hear, Dean Nielsen could really has a macro view of the world. He has a macro understanding of populations. He has a macro view of the historical transitional states of medicine, public and private. And the future is in his head. He has to merge this into a curriculum and to understand the value to training people who go through this medical school. And by the way, it's extraordinary medical school. I'm not going to elaborate on that. I just wanted you to get an insight into the power of collaboration, because Dr. Shanley told me right after this meeting, he has a meeting with Dr. Nielsen. So to give you an insight,
oh, really?
These are collaborations. These are collaborations, and we're very honored that you came today. Thank you very much.
So you're not going to let me hijack your lecture series? Thank
you. Not this minute.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very, very much. That was an honored guest, and we have four honored guests, and the second honored guest today is Mr. Patrick Magoon. Many of you know him from Lurie Children's. He is a visionary thinker also in the area of pediatrics. He has a caseload input that's extraordinary. And I would like many of you either know him because you've taken your children, your grandchildren, but I would like Patrick to come up. Thank you. And if you would model the questions a little bit of strategic thoughts, Because, you know, just like we sit in strategic planning for our next year, Pastor Maroon and all the people he works with, these great leaders, have to imagine the next steps in their, in order to be able to serve their population. We in business call it clients. So I just think he's such a gifted leader that face Patrick.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and thank you for those very kind words. And kind of interesting, the power of collaboration, I think, is a great topic, because it really represents what we've been doing for a long time, in fact, in partnership with the medical school. So ironically, tomorrow will be 5 years and 5 months to the day when we move from Lincoln Park to the Streeterville community. Time flies when you're having fun. And I would dare say we're not the same institution we were when we were in Lincoln Park, and that's purposeful. Because as the board took the opportunity to look at our future and really decide what does the city expect, what does the civic leadership want for its children, it was really the opportunity to create a world-class institution. And as we looked at the best children's hospitals in the country, there were a couple of common characteristics among all of them. First and foremost, they were all on the campus of their medical school partner. We weren't. And that 3 miles made a huge difference. Second, they were all affiliated with a top 10 medical school, and neither Northwestern nor we could achieve our vision of being top 10 institutions without working and collaborating together. And that physical co-location was a critical element to accomplishing that. And if you look at the rankings of all of us here on the medical school campus, with the exception of, obviously, the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, which is historically number one, the rest of us are now elevating our reputation through that collaboration. So when we made the move, it was not necessarily about making the move, being here, taking a breather and say, it's done. That was really the first step. And what we always talked about was really kind of, now we need to deliver on the promise of what we expected to come out of that institution and its physical rebirth. And so if you think about what's occurred over the last 5 years, there's been a tremendous partnership between the medical school, Northwestern Memorial Hospital, and Lurie Children's in helping us do what we wanted to do, and that's recruit the very best minds in pediatric medicine and science. And so I'll just highlight one example that's real, and I think important, and that is when we were in Lincoln Park, we could never develop a fetal surgical program. There were no babies being born at our institution, and they weren't even close. And if you think about caring for children, at one time it was developing a relationship with the pediatricians, and when they needed our care, we were available to care for their patient. But as neonatology developed as a specialty, if you didn't develop that partnership with the moms who had children with medical complexity in the first 5 hours or 5 days, they were off into some other system, or they were getting care somewhere else, ending up coming down to our place and having work done that probably could have been avoided. So we developed our neonatology program. Now, it's really backed up even a step further. And it's that first ultrasound at which point in time many childhood defects are being identified. And it's partnering with the maternal fetal medicine folks who are with Northwestern to help identify those problems and to solve those problems that we can in utero. And in the last 2 weeks, we actually performed our first myelin meningocele repair on a baby in utero, a woman who self-referred to the program. We couldn't do that in Lincoln Park. And that's where really advancements are taking place. With our partnership now with the medical school and the work Dr. Shanley is doing, we're looking to recruit a placental physiologist, really looking at what's happening with the placenta and its development, whether it's lung development, circulatory development, and really going as early as we possibly can. And that's what this move is all about. How do we advance pediatric medicine and science in ways that will improve value, meaning we are getting earlier interventions so that you reduce a lifelong experience for patients or minimize it, and how do we create new knowledge? And you need this kind of environment to provide that training, that synergy. It doesn't happen in a place that's apart from, but in more importantly, embedded in the medical school. And so some of the recruitments that Dean Nielsen has accomplished, whether it's Dr. L. George and the work he's doing in pharmacology with salt deficiency in children who have epilepsy, And the team that Dr. Shannon leads with Dr. Leon Epstein, one of the largest collection of those children with that problem. I mean, the synergies here were beginning organically. And now under Dr. Shanley's leadership, we've developed our Vision 2025 that lays out our long-range strategic plan, making investments in a number of programs, three key programs initially, that are really going to move the needle for kids. And that's what the community expected when we created this plan, and that's what we're now beginning to deliver on. Our hope is that down the road, the government doesn't mess it up. Because quite honestly, when you think about the work that we're doing collectively on this campus, from that first ultrasound to long-term rehabilitative care for adults, it's really about the lifetime cost of care and how are resources provided to incentivize providers and educators and others to provide excellence, because they're all out of whack. There is no synergy there. And it's true in the private market, too. If you're an insurance company, A, B, or C, whatever name you want to pick, and you're contracted with company A, you know, you want to manage their costs for that year that you have the coverage agreement with. But a lot of the work we do, whether it's a children who are now adults with survivors of adult congenital disease, or any other example you want to choose, is to really manage the lifetime of care. And sometimes you have to spend more money in that 1 year to save dollars long term. So we've got to change the financing of the system. And so collectively, those are the kinds of things we're looking at. But you know, that's the exciting part about being here. That's the exciting part about being able to recruit great partners like Dr. Shanley and his team and others to the community. It's about really taking that next step forward. And I think there are probably going to be a handful of places in the United States that will have the critical mass and the resources to do that. And with your support, we'll be one of them. So thank you.
Thank you. That was terrific. And you know, on other campuses, you say, oh, well, this occurs. Many times, this institution at that medical complex does not work with that institute. It's very true in universities. Without naming them, I can think of four on the East Coast that can't go within their own edifice to get partners. They need to go to another university. And it's a sign of maturity. It's a sign that healthcare is at the purity of their hearts. And I thank you. Now, I'm going to bring up the other doctors. First of all, we must thank Karen. She's been an extraordinary leader. Mary Ann, extraordinary leader. These are sophisticated doctors, and they have great sense of humor. I have to tell you, I think it was someone else who said that they... Dr. Nielsen know that they were such great physicians, but they really have given us such a course that every time you give one of these talks, we get a summary of what that is. Many of our classmates travel, and we all do from time to time, and miss these, and so we listen to them audibly. However, we get a summary within 2 days, and I thank you very much for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Shirley. I know Dr. Nielsen was listening when you said those nice words about me and Mary Ann. We're pretty excited to work here again next year. So I get the pleasure of introducing two of our two speakers for today. You know, our theme has been the power of collaboration, and that can be in many forms. We've seen senior faculty and their junior mentees. This is a great example of an established Northwestern faculty member and a relatively new Northwestern faculty member. So it's great to recruit new people, but they have to be able to collaborate with the established faculty in order to reach their potential and also to reach across from the adult world to the pediatric world. So I'm going to introduce Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones. Don is an outstanding leader at Northwestern. He's a professor in the Department of Medicine, a cardiologist. He graduated from Columbia Medical School, then spent some time at Harvard. So he was fairly well-trained, I mean pretty decent. He's the chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine here, which is actually the number one department in research grants in the country. Don is interested in prevention. So we talk about healing sickness and treating disease, but Don's interest and his passion is prevention. And if you have time later to read the Healthy Life's Healthy Seven, that I urge you to think about it, because there's so much evidence now that we can live well into old age by taking care of ourselves in adolescence and middle age. Did I get that right, Don? I'm not done yet. Don has become very purple over time. His wife also works at Northwestern. His oldest son is now a
junior,
who is featured on TV a lot because he goes to all the football games. So I really appreciate that.
That's what my tuition is paying for.
You know, that's right. And our next speaker is Tom Shanley. Tom, as we heard, is the chair of pediatrics and also the head of research at Lurie Children's. Tom came to Northwestern about 2 years ago. He's a native Chicagoan, attended University of Chicago for medical school, spent some time at University of Pennsylvania, and then was in faculty at Michigan, where he was also, in addition to having leadership role, pediatrics, was also an associate dean for research. And I was on the search committee, actually, for the new chair of pediatrics, and Dr. Nielsen gave us a whole list of things that he wanted to see, and we were meeting, let's say, about 10 different people. And, you know, somewhere in the middle, in walks Tom Shanley and spends 10 minutes with us. And then after that, I think I actually stood up and said, well, I think we're done here, because this is the guy. So we were really, really lucky to recruit Tom from Michigan. And I just want to say on a personal note, Mary Ann and I have a very dear friend who had a son hospitalized at Lurie last week in the ICU. And I'll tell you, the pediatric ICU is a really scary place, even for us seasoned physicians who walk in and out of the medical ICU and the surgical ICU and the neurosurgical ICU, don't even notice. And the pediatric ICU at Lurie is a very scary place, even for visitors. But the care that our friend's son received was so unbelievably impressive and amazing, even for us hard-to-impress physicians. And I just want to thank you, Tom, for having faculty who and nurses and fostering this collaboration and excellence for our friend's son, who was discharged doing great and is now back in his exerciser, and so all is well. But thank you. All right, Don and Tom, please come up.
Thanks, Diane. Well, good morning. It's always great to see this audience. I want to thank Ms. Ryan for inviting me back. I think I spoke to you about 8 years ago or so, thinking about prevention. We've come a long way since then. But today, as you know, we're going to talk about collaboration. And this is something that I think is near and dear to both Tom's and my hearts. And I can say that, yes, I did train at a nice institution back east. But the reason that I came to Northwestern 14 years ago was entirely because of the collaborative potential here. Back east, in that small little place, you know, next to Massachusetts Bay, it's all silos. It's really hard as a young investigator to break into the fiefdoms that exist there. Here, it could not have been easier. And to create a network of researchers, to be able to build a Department of Preventive Medicine, you know, from an incredibly strong foundation, but to take it to the next level, was all about attracting scientists who want to work in groups and in teams. And that is, I think, one of the special, part of the secret sauce, I think, of what Northwestern, Lurie, and Northwestern Medicine really have become. So it's a really pleasure to talk about collaboration today, because it is really what we're living and breathing on campus here every day. So this is the outline for what we're going to cover. And, you know, it's always jeopardy. When you let the bosses talk first, nobody's going to cut them off, right? So we're going to accelerate a little bit. But I think the important thing to think about here is we're going to talk about collaboration within a new, relatively new area of concentration, which is what all of medical research is now about, and it's called translational science. Has anybody heard that phrase before, translational science or translational research? This is what the entire story has become about now, because for too long, people made scientific discoveries for the sake of making scientific discoveries, and there they sat, when some of them had real potential to change health. And it's sometimes hard to tell which ones can go all the way and which ones can't. So we've had to actually create an entirely new discipline of supporting and evaluating the potential for translational science. And we're going to give you a couple of examples of how that's now working here on campus. So when we're talking about translational science, we're really talking about bench to bedside and the implementation of knowledge into healthcare and public health settings. And as I said, we're going to talk a little bit about two examples of that. So translational research, you can see the words here, but basically, you know, if you want to think about a concept, it's bench to bedside and beyond. Again, that early discovery that happens in a wet lab, basic scientists, research laboratory, needs to get to first-in-human research. There are a lot of barriers from getting to a cell through animals to first-in-human research. Then it needs to get to treating populations of patients, and then it needs to get to implementation in practice and out to the population. That is a very, very long process, which is now actually starting to accelerate. We have some wonderful examples. Tom's going to talk about how that typical cycle of success takes 20 years from discovery to implementation, and only about 1% of those discoveries actually make it through that cycle. And even the good ones take 20 years. Now we have a recent example in my field of cardiovascular disease, 7 years from discovery to an FDA-approved therapeutic, which is revolutionizing the treatment of cholesterol. So we've learned a lot about how to do this better. So this is a concept that first appeared only in 1993 with the discovery of the BRCA1 gene, obviously related to breast and other cancers. But it wasn't really, there wasn't much uptake until the early 2000s. And the reason why there was a paradigm shift is often the way things like this happen. The Institute of Medicine, now called the National Academy of Medicine, really started to understand this was the problem in translating knowledge into the to the bedside. And they pinpointed two blockages of translation of knowledge into practice. And the first, again, was that bench-to-bedside problem. And the second was getting docs to actually use it once we had proven it works. So translation, get it to humans, show it works, but then actually get uptake in public practice and in medical practice. So this is kind of a typical cartoon that you see. Here's the wet lab basic scientist with his Erlenmeyer flask and his test tubes sitting over here. Here's the doc trying to figure out what to do for this poor patient over here. And this valley of death, this chasm, was the problem of translation, right? So this is, again, still there, but I would say now we're probably here. It's not quite as deep a hole, and we're not digging a deeper hole anymore, which is nice to see. So this is the first kind of paradigm that was put out there. We talked about a T1 translation block, again, getting from basic to first in human studies, and then we talked about a T2 block of getting uptake of new knowledge into clinical practice. And that was a nice paradigm for starters in the early 2000s, but again, it didn't really represent the full spectrum of complexity of the problems of translation. Incomplete in the sense that there are many phases of clinical studies. You have to prove safety, and then you have to start to prove efficacy in very defined patient populations, and then you have to do it in bigger populations, and then you have to roll out the drug or device and see what actually happens in real people. Because too many times we find that when we've done small studies, we don't have the adverse reactions or the safety problems when we're only looking at a few patients. When we start to treat thousands of patients, oftentimes something comes up that's really a problem. And if we had done the better studies or the bigger studies earlier, we would know that. Understanding scalability and, again, implementation of the big problems. So this is really our current paradigm of translation. We now understand that there are sort of four major hurdles or gaps in this process, going from basic scientific discovery all the way to the health of the community or population. Again, demonstration of the potential that this could actually affect human health. Then first in human studies and showing that it can be efficacious as well as safe. Then bringing it out to clinical practice through guidelines and then actual assessments of quality of care. Are docs using the best and newest things that they should be, and then finally translating it all the way to the population. So with that kind of framework around translation, I'm now going to turn it over to Tom, who's going to give you some examples of collaborative work within the translational science space.
Is that okay? Terrific. Thank you, Don. And Shirley, thank you very much for the opportunity to share some thoughts with us. So as Don said, these are actually some of the measurements of the challenges in terms of a lack of translation. So what this demonstrates here is when you look at the number of investigators that have been funded to do basic research activities and what the consequence in terms of new output from that has been. You can see even industry is spending a lot more money on research and development, but with a huge increase in the number of investigators and investments in the dollars, we aren't getting the output that one would expect from the translational enterprise. And so this concept of being able to try to drive better collaborations toward better outcomes is clear that there was a huge need there in the industry. The other thing, as Don mentioned, is if you look at some of these developments, first of all, there's a lot of failures that are actually listed in here from the standpoint. They ended up not showing benefit. Here's the ones that actually end up showing some benefit. And if you look at the timeline, this is broken down by decades. So right here alone, that's 20 years of development from a discovery to actually having a bedside impact. That's just too long for us to deal with. So when you looked at these clear, this wasn't people thinking maybe we had a problem. These are clear measurements that we had a major problem in translation. So what are some of the things that we may have seen? The infrastructure and the organization of the research programs, a part of this was the way NIH chose to fund certain research programs that maybe were fundamentally basic science, but not understanding what their potential implication in human biology and human health might be. The public really had little say in the participation of research. We didn't really know what was important in terms of public health concerns, and maybe we should be thinking about how we fund, train, and invest in research programs that address those concerns. I highlight clearly training of investigators, and jump down to the inadequate collaboration. That's why I asterisk the training of investigators. The traditional mechanism and pathway was that you had one individual that ran a lab, and his little team ran around that lab, and you came into that lab and you learned how to do the same thing in a very siloed mentality. There was nothing about team science, which you'll hear Don emphasize later. There was nothing about how you reach out across the hallways or across centers to really amplify new technologies and borrow skills and understanding from colleagues. But that was the model that we had. So now we're training investigators in a different way. Inadequate or potentially wrong targeted funding and an inadequate prioritization of the resources and the types of research. Now there's been significant investments into translational research. And part of that came from the NIH leadership, the National Institutes of Health leadership, saying we need to emphasize this as a priority in the organization. And so the establishment of this new institute, this is the most recent institute that was started by the NIH, called the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, or NCATS. And so the program that Don leads here, the Northwestern University Center for Advancing Translational Science, or NUCATS, and the program that I led at the University of Michigan were members of the sites that were supported by this new institute focusing on translation. So now, how does this impact on kids and how does it impact on adults? And so I'd like to share a story with you. I apologize, Diane. The PICU's not supposed to be a scary place. We know what we're doing, and we have a terrific team, as you mentioned. But this story is something that's very relevant to my practice. I work in the pediatric intensive care unit all the time. So we have a 4-year-old little girl who's had 3 days of a mild fever with some runny nose and cough, very typical for an upper respiratory infection. But on the past day, her breathing has gotten faster and seems to be harder by her mom's description. And she's continuing to have fever and getting more irritable. Her mom video connects. Now I'm using a little bit of license here. Her mom video connects with their pediatrician after applying what we call a JRHMV1. I'll explain to you what that is. And that happens to read tachycardia with mild lactate elevation. And the pediatrician sees a fatigued child with some labored breathing. So they're referred directly to the Lurie Children's Hospital Emergency Department. And in there you can see that she has a temperature of 103, her heart rate is too high for a child her age at 172, same with her respiratory rate at 48, and her oxygen saturation, which is a measure of oxygen in the bloodstream, which normally should be around 100%, is quite low at 86%. She's very tired by this point, but when you go in to examine her, she arouses her. She arouses okay. When you listen to her lungs, you hear this abnormal sound with your stethoscope on the right side of her lungs. And you can see that her extremities are sort of cool and she's peripherally looks very clamped down. So you put her on oxygen to raise that oxygen in her bloodstream, and we collect blood for the following things. Okay? First of all, we do what's called a rapid pathogen detection assay, and it tells us that she has Staphylococcus aureus, a germ. We do what I describe as an immune-targeted whole exome sequencing of genomic DNA, which happens to be negative. We do a microfluidic-based proteomic analysis for mediator multiplex, and her interleukin 8 level is 160 picograms per mil. We do a leukoimmunophenotyping that identifies normal monocyte HLA-DR expression and a good functional response. Now, we actually don't do any of this, but this is the future. And I'm going to describe to you what these imply and how collaborations are driving to make this a reality for a girl like this in the very near future. Okay? So based on this information, which demonstrates that she has a pneumonia here, very similar to the child that we took care of, antibiotics are given, she's admitted to the intensive care unit, but we are able to reassure the parents that actually, based on the profile we just got from her blood, her risk of getting really sick is pretty low. So we've got this mom, we've got this dad, okay? She's gonna be good in our hands. So how does collaboration enable this kind of future, okay? So the key here is often bringing problem identifiers. I got kids who get sick from pneumonias all the time. They often died. That's part of why I got into intensive care unit and why I got into my research enterprise. And I have these clinical problems. Who can help me understand their clinical entity and help me solve the problems? And so often bringing a clinician together with someone like an engineer can help identify that. So these are some of the examples of how we can do that. So how might it be in the future that we ascertain clinical status to better optimize when and where a patient should be seen and triaged to? Now, I think many of you probably had the opportunity to hear Dr. Rogers speak recently. So the JR, the John Rogers, human monitoring version 1, is my example of what the future may bring from this standpoint. He described to you these wireless sensing technologies that we can put on an individual and get a variety of readings, such as their heart rate, and maybe be able to do some measurements either from the sweat or the blood, like an elevated lactate that we identified. Now, he describes to you the opportunity to put these on. Think about what you needed to move this forward. I think he probably described to you as one example, Amy Poller, our chair of dermatology. How might this device react with a neonate skin? Because those are some of the kids that we're putting this on. A premature, very thin skin, can it handle this? That's the kind of collaboration to understand how we can scale and implement this kind of monitoring in the neonatal and pediatric intensive care units that we need. So this is coming to an intensive care unit and hopefully a home nearby you soon. The second thing we did is we did this rapid pathogen detection assay. You never quite know who you might need to help understand some things. So through my career, is part of what we learned is we always thought the germs were really the bad guys. You can see this, there's this little, that's called a gram-negative rod germ that's sitting right on a patient's lung ciliated. That's what cilia in our lung cells look like. And when the cilia sees these pathogens, it wasn't really the germ that we were to blame. It was how our bodies reacted to that germ that gets kids and adults very sick. So understanding how the body responds to this germ was critical. So we have to know both the germ and we have to know both how the body responds to it. So think about the collaborators that are needed to understand that complexity of the response. On the germ side, you need microbiologists. You need, believe it or not, there are people that study the genetics of bacteria, just like we have people that study the genetics of humans, right? We have scientists that understand the immunologic response to germs. We have engineers that advance the technologies that we use from that standpoint, and these create lots of data. You need people that understand it, can compute it, and can analyze it statistically from that standpoint. Who would have ever thought that food and water scientists would help us understand this and help us understand how to detect pathogens in bloodstream? But you know what? When you make a mistake in canning or food processing and you have germs in the food, a lot of people get sick. So they have to know whether there's germs in those things. So when you think about advancing biodetection of germs, why not apply that to human beings? And so it's this advancement of technology that comes from a completely separate field that collaboration can really advance our ability to detect germs in that. Now, I'm not going to talk to you about, you know, how that's doing that, but there's no question that re-engineering how we look for germs in humans can really escalate quickly. These are just some of the fancy examples. Traditionally, what we do is we take blood, and we hope maybe in the first 12 hours, often longer, we grow a germ out of that blood. But with advancing technologies from the blood, we don't have to wait for the germ to grow. We can identify it directly. And if we do so, think about how important it is to move that critical time of starting the right antibiotic earlier. So the better we can do this, the sooner we can get the right antibiotic into the child and the patient. Really critical to improving critical outcomes. Now, this concept that I described in terms of immune-targeted whole exome sequencing of the genomic DNA. So what we aim to do in the evolving future is to leverage individuals' genomic information. That's the information collected in their DNA to allow us to make more precise decisions. So have you heard precision medicine or personalized medicine? What that means is trying to utilize all this information to understand how in this particular individual the disease process might progress. So this is being advanced extremely quickly by this concept of our ability to now make the sequence, understand the sequence of the genome at a much, much reduced cost. You see, the first $100 million to do the genome project. But now we're accelerating this to the point where pretty much for somewhere around $1,000 to $2,000, we can now get the genome sequence individuals to ask the right information of what that individual contains in their DNA. So I'm going to just pause for a second and give you a simplified video of how we hope to be utilizing this.
In recent years, you may have heard the term precision medicine and inferred that it has something to do with tailoring treatments for individual patients. But how is this done? And how will we lead these efforts at Lurie Children's? Precision medicine is all about finding specialized treatments that combine everything we know about a disease, plus everything we know about that individual who has the disease. When we study a disease, our scientists are not just observing tissues and tumors under microscopes. We're now interrogating them at their most basic cellular level. Then we factor in each patient's unique biological composition, including things like each child's DNA, genetics, health history, environment, metabolism, proteins, and how his or her body reacts to different drugs. So precision medicine means saying goodbye to the idea that a certain drug is the best choice for all children with the same disease. Instead, each child's treatment will be based on the underlying cause of the disease, as well as unique biologic characteristics that help us know how they will react to different therapies. What's more, this process also becomes an iterative cycle. Over time, we will be able to collect and analyze much deeper data from many individual patients with the same disorder, and this will help us discover new precision therapies. At first, we'll focus on cancer and epilepsy. Ultimately, we will apply precision medicine to virtually all conditions we treat at Lurie Children's. The goal of precision medicine is more cures, less toxicity, and a better quality of life. We are eager to dive into this process head first and help usher in a new era in medicine.
So you can imagine the number of collaborators as you look at the iterative cycle from basic science and genomic understanding to clinical trials into implementation, as Don will to talk more about. Now, the last part is this concept of a microfluidic proteomic analysis for looking at biomarkers and this leukoimmunophenotyping component of it. Now, I will say we're actually closer to this to being a reality than some of the other ones. So I have to harken back to my initial collaboration with Hector Wong, who's the director of critical care medicine at Cincinnati Children's. And a long time ago, we decided that we thought it might be important to be able to collect information about how children who are critically ill from an infection, their body is responding immunologically. And you can't do this. No one center gets enough of these kids in a period of time that allows you to get insight. So we have to collaborate with the 17 other centers. So this was an 18-center project to collect a few hundred patients with this severity of illness. And what we did is looked at this expression profiling. You don't have to know anything about it except, I think you all know colors, right? So if you look at the colors here, you can see that when we looked at expression and we said, computer, just tell us which patients look like they have the same colors of expression patterns, the computer just drew these boxes around these groups that were subclassed. We said, well, that's really interesting that we got three major groups out of all this. What happens to them? We didn't look at what happened to them and then get this. We asked what happens to them when they look like this. And it turned out if you looked at that one particular group, this is the death, this is the mortality rate. So typically only about 10% of children that get this sick in an intensive care unit pass away. This group that had that unusual, that one expression pattern, had about four times the death rate. Four times the death rate. That means we've got to be doing something different and something special when kids come in with a profile that looks like that. So wouldn't you want to have that information? So not only did we get this piece, but then we said, well, but we got to give clinicians this information to do things differently. So how could we use this from that standpoint? Now, ideally, you think about, you got to get this now because the kid's coming into the intensive care unit. You want it to be accurate. It'd be nice if it could be automated, and we're working on that, and quickly from that standpoint so that it's at the point of care, so that you can get it in the intensive care unit or in the clinical lab in the hospital, and hopefully isn't exorbitantly costly from the standpoint of being have everyone available to it. So what we developed was we tried to develop a technological solution, and the only way that we could do this was by bringing people who had skills and expertise about microfluidics and physics that I had no idea. So what you see here is 6 engineers, biomedical engineers, with 3 intensive care clinicians collaborating together to try to find the solution technically to be able to do this. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of how this works, but we describe this as turning gold into gold, because if we can actually get this to work, we really feel this would be such a great win for pediatrics. But what we do is we are able to bind things to gold particles. And these things are able to detect stuff that we felt were important based on that expression profiling that we identified. So if we could determine this expression quickly, we'd be able to make the right clinical management decisions. This is how the process moves forward. But what I wanted to show here is in a very unique finding, within 35 minutes, we're able to measure key important things of the body's response in the bloodstream. That's the kind of time and the speed of information that we've never had before. They've been measurements that usually take 4 or 8 hours, and often we wouldn't even do them on the same day. But here we can do it within 30 minutes of having the information. And the other important thing, I mentioned this immune phenotyping. What this demonstrates here are just two things. When the body's cells are developed normally, they express this thing called HLA-DR. And when the body gets sick, that expression level drops for reasons we don't fully understand. In addition, when a germ hits the body, a healthy body should say, that doesn't belong here. I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to respond. And this is a measurement of that kind of response. So normal kids have a big response, and they have a lot of expression of this protein. And what you see here is that in certain kids, when their cells are not healthy and they're not responding, those kids develop a lot of infection. They're the only kids that develop infections in the hospital. And unfortunately, they're the only kids, except for one, that die from their severe illness. So if we could have that information, couldn't we do things differently and actually be able to stimulate their immune system to fight their infection more severely? So that was the drive. That was the clinical challenge. How do we solve that? Can we get this information in real time? So that moved us to work with the same engineering collaborators to figure out this possibility of using a small chip to isolate the cells and test their functional responses to be able to demonstrate that the immune system was either working or not. And so again, I just have schemas here demonstrating what we do is we isolate the cells from that and goes into this little chip, which has these stems. And you can see that the immune cells are stuck here around this chip, very nicely lighting up. And then in the second stage, what we do is we stimulate them, we give them something that should make them respond, and we use that biomarker platform that I described to you that gives us the answer within 30 minutes. So now we have a platform that can isolate the cells, test for their functional immune response, and give us a readout in real time in something that used to take us 2 days. And we didn't even really do it in 2 days. We collected all the patient samples and studied them later in time. But now this moves us in a manner that starts to get real time. And so you can see that in testing, if we actually deactivate the body's immune system, we're able to pick this system, can pick this up and give us the right information accurately, in addition to being able to tell us when the system is working well. So this is coming to an intensive care unit and a pediatric intensive care unit in the near future. But it's get the sense of the identification of the problem and how the collaboration with unique skill sets really start to identify a solution. And it's really only through those kinds of collaborations that we'll be able to address these big challenges. So now moving from sort of the early stage of translation into the later stage of translation, I'm going to turn it back over to Don.
All right, I am back. And I loved that. That was really awesome, Don. I'm going to talk to you about another example of collaboration in the form of a newly funded center, funded by the American Heart Association that we have here at Northwestern. And notice, you can already get a sense that there's collaboration going on. There are investigators from Lurie Children's, there are investigators from Northwestern, both on the Evanston campus as well as down here in Chicago, and this new institute that was just formed within the last year called the Developmental Sciences Institute, which played a key role in pulling together the team that ultimately successfully competed for funding. So we've talked about translation, we've talked about collaboration. One of the sort of underlying themes here is something called team science, another phrase that gets batted around a lot these days, but is incredibly important for how we do this science. And Tom, I think, gave you a good sense of that. Well, it turns out that Northwestern is a world leader in understanding the concepts of team science. On the Evanston campus, Nash Contractor and Brian Uzi are world-renowned for understanding what makes a successful scientific team. What's, again, that secret sauce that pulls people together and leads to new discoveries and translation. And in fact, Northwestern and through our CTSA, the New Katz Institute, we started what is now the leading conference in the world on the science of team science, called the CITES Conference. And we're also leaders in the practice of team science. And one of the investigators of our CTSA, Bonnie Spring, leads our team science efforts in putting our knowledge into practice in how to form, launch, and mature effective scientific teams. And if you're interested in this concept, we've actually created an online course to teach investigators how to practice team science in action. So there are 5 different modules, some basic stuff, and then different areas of science where it sort of walks people through, how to become an effective team scientist. So worth checking out if you have any interest. Okay, so what are some of the important principles of team science and effective teams that we've learned and that were really front and center in the development of the application and the successful funding of this center I'm going to tell you about? First, you have to check your ego at the door. It'd be nice to think that as an individual, one knows absolutely everything. Can't happen. The world is far too complex. The world of biomedicine, especially, is far too complex, as Tom just demonstrated. So we have to be humble and admit the things that we don't know. Very important as a new team is forming is learning the vocabulary of your collaborators. An example I'm going to give you, we were working with neurodevelopmental scientists. I am an adult cardiologist. The brain is something that my organ gives blood to. I know nothing about what happens above the throat. Nothing, right? The brain is a very scary place for me. I'm a big, dumb white guy. I just don't go there. But we're not talking about the organ. We're actually talking about the function of the brain and how it develops through childhood. So I had to learn an entirely new vocabulary just to be able to understand what our colleagues were talking about and to get the concepts down and find the touch points that would allow us to create this really important team. It took time. It took a lot of time. We had to bang our heads against the wall for a while until we found that common vocabulary where we could actually talk to each other. We knew we had the germ of a great story, of important science, and that's what kept us all at the table. So finding that story and being able to tell it was a key part of this journey. Each of us brought our own expertise to the table. And we had to learn to trust each other that, you know, you're the expert in this area, you tell us what's the right thing to do when we're talking about that area, and then again, let your ego go. You have to do the handoff, the pass off to the person who's next in line at those touch points. So compromise, really important, finding those synergies. And when we did it, one plus one, or in this case, you know, many plus many, added up to much more than just the sum of the parts. And that, I think, is what team science ultimately becomes about, is that whole being much greater than the sum of the parts. So let me give you an example. So the American Heart Association about 3 years ago said, in addition to continuing to fund individual scientists with their good ideas to try to push forward treatment of and prevention of cardiovascular disease, they put out these calls for what are called strategically focused research networks. So the Heart Association says, this is really important and mission critical for us. We want expert institutions to come together and solve problems in specific areas that we decide, that don't bubble up from the investigators, but that the Heart Association says, mission critical, you tell us how we're going to tackle this problem. So they've put out these, these requests to form research networks, each of which contains four centers at an expert institution, and each center gets $3.8 million over 4 years to really dive deep into this and to work with the other four centers to try to come together collaboratively and come to a solution. To date, they've funded networks in prevention, hypertension, disparities in cardiovascular disease, women's cardiovascular health, heart failure, and obesity. And these things are, I can tell you, revolutionizing, because we have to work with the other centers. We can't just sit here at Northwestern and do what we do here. I am very proud to say that Northwestern is the only institution in the country that has three of these centers funded. How many does Harvard have? Duke just got one. They're fine. Hopkins has one and a half, kind of. UCSF? No, sorry. Why? I can tell you why. Because we know how to give an application that shows we're going to synergize across basic science, clinical science, and population science, and really speed up translation. That is our secret sauce. And we've learned how to tell this story well because we've got great scientists and we are not afraid to talk to people in areas we know nothing about. So that's really, I think, what this story is about. So last fall, AHA put out a call for a strategically focused research network on children. The institutions, Lurie and Northwestern, got together and asked myself and Brad Marino, who's a pediatric cardiologist, to put together the application for Northwestern and Lurie. So you got 2 months, go, to put together about a 1,500-page scientific application. Let's go. But again, the time that it took, we spent the first 4 weeks easily banging our heads on the wall, trying to figure out what was the story. How are we going to tackle what we know the problem is with colleagues who can help us make new insights, not just the same old insights? So here was our problem. We know cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular health are determined very early in life. And I'm going to show you some examples of how we know that from population studies. So how can we start kids off healthier earlier and affect their long-term trajectories of cardiovascular health? What happens to them when they're 40, 50, 60, 70? Because the more we know, the more we are programmed very early in life to actually have a great health trajectory or a not so great health trajectory. How do we know this? Well, just to kind of set a little bit more of the stage, AHA is actually currently has a strategic mission of improving the cardiovascular health of all Americans, and has actually put out a definition I'll share with you in a second about what ideal cardiovascular health looks like. This is our ideal, this is our optimal, and we know that if people can sustain that to middle age, it virtually eliminates the chance that they will develop cardiovascular disease during their remaining lifespan, and I'll show you some data on that in a second, while they are also living a lot longer and also not getting cancer or dementia or other things. This is what we call compressing morbidity. If you can have ideal cardiovascular health, you live longer, but you're not living longer at the expense of living longer sick. You're actually getting sick much closer to the time you die. So you're squaring that curve of morbidity. Healthy, 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 die. Not healthy, little less healthy, little less healthy, little less healthy, little less healthy. Last 10 years are miserable, right? What we're really trying to do is compress that morbidity right to the end of life because, big secret, nobody gets out of here alive, right? Gotta die, so you want to spend as little time as possible sick. And this is really, this is the fountain of youth. This is the secret of how we can do that. So primordial prevention becomes key. What is primordial prevention? Well, I think many people are familiar with secondary prevention. You've had a heart attack, let's not let you have another heart attack. That's what we call secondary prevention. Primary prevention, well, you have diabetes, or you have high blood pressure, or bad cholesterol. Let's not have you, let you have that first heart attack. Primordial prevention, how about we don't let you get hypertension in the first place? Not let you develop diabetes in the first place? Because by the time you've done that, there's enough damage that's already accrued. The horse is well out of the barn, and we can never put it all the way back in. So primordial prevention becomes really key, and that's why it's so important to start early in life. Okay, so here's the document that defines this ideal of cardiovascular health. I was really fortunate to lead this for the American Heart Association with a team of absolute superstars from Northwestern and other places. And here again is what the AHA is doing during this decade, trying to improve the cardiovascular health of all Americans by 20% during this decade, while continuing to reduce deaths from cardiovascular disease and stroke by a further 20% as well. Anybody know what's the leading cause of death in this country and around the world? So cause, not underlying risk factor, but cause. Cardiovascular disease, right? Not even close, by the way. How much has cardiovascular disease death rates declined over the last 40 years in this country? 70%. And it's still the leading cause of death in this country. Huge success story, miles to go, right? So if we can actually get that next level of primordial prevention and improve cardiovascular health, that's kind of the paradigm shift that can push us forward. So in defining cardiovascular health, no surprises here, right? No smoking, eat a heart healthy diet. We know what that looks like. Participate in physical activity, maintain a healthy body weight, and keep your blood sugar, blood cholesterol, and blood pressure at good levels. That's what ideal cardiovascular health looks like across the lifespan. Now, we can define different levels of these things, poor, intermediate, and ideal. We created a score around cardiovascular health, so you can actually go online and calculate your cardiovascular health score through the AHA website if you're interested in doing that. But look what happens to people at that age of 50. Anybody here 50? Yeah. So this is the Framingham Heart Study, which has been going on for a long time. And when we looked at data, as people passed through their 50th birthday in Framingham, we said, okay, do you have ideal cardiovascular health? Not quite optimal levels, elevated, or a major risk factor. And look what happens over the remainder of the lifespan. If you're 50 with two major risk factors, 69% of men and 50% of women will have a major cardiovascular event before they die. Even if you're not quite optimal, a third will have a major cardiovascular event before you die. But look at these folks. They've almost abolished their cardiovascular risk by making it to 50 with ideal cardiovascular health. About 2% of the population can do this. Not because we're genetically programmed to lose our cardiovascular health by age 50, but because of our environment and our behaviors largely driving this. So this is modifiable, but we don't do a very good job of getting here. These are special people. We could all do this, potentially. Okay, so knowing that, we actually have a different AHA center that looks at cardiovascular health from age 8 to 55. And we were able to pull together data from multiple different studies to look at what are the trajectories of cardiovascular health from ages 8 to 55. So what you can see here is This is a big data problem. You guys, I know, have heard about big data. We let the data tell us what their trajectories are. We didn't go in saying, well, we think there's this one and that one and that one. We said, calculate the cardiovascular health score for individuals across their lifespan from 8 to 55 and tell us what are the patterns that emerge from the data. And we found five consistent patterns. Three of those patterns start with quite high cardiovascular health. This group tends to maintain it pretty well. This group loses it a little bit late. This group loses it early. There's kind of this intermediate group that tends to stay pretty stable. And then there's a group that's already poorer and tends to lose it early and quickly. So there are five general groups of people out there. But notice that by age 8, here's age 50, right, that magical moment. But by age 8, there's already some stratification. You can't tell these people apart, but there's already something that's changed in the rest of them. And if we look across the U.S. population, again, here's our trivial number of people who by age 60 have maintained cardiovascular health, right? Notice, by age 12 to 19, only about 40% of our adolescents have high levels of cardiovascular health. So we wondered, okay, there's that. What's happening back here? Do we start with perfect cardiovascular health and lose it, you know, lose that much by age 12 in the population? Or are there people who already don't have cardiovascular health that's ideal and they lose it too? So this was a big black box for us. We don't know what's happening upstream, really, from from birth to about age 8 to 12. So enter the team. Brad Marino's our center director, worked closely with him, and we actually looked around the medical center and around Evanston to say, who can help us fill in that black box? Darwin Labarthe has been thinking about this for a long time. He was actually the head of heart and stroke prevention at CDC for more than a decade. He's now on our faculty here, so we knew we had to have him as a big thinker part of the team. Lori Wachschlag is in the Department of Medical Social Sciences. She started this Developmental Sciences Institute. She is a pediatric neurodevelopmental specialist. She's a psychologist. She had to tell us, how do kids' brains develop and create patterns of habits, right? Because we know that early dietary habit formation, the likelihood and enjoyment of participation in physical activity, the ability to inhibit, let's say, those darker desires to eat the Reese's peanut butter cup, right? How do kids learn discipline about their health? And this is what Lori really focuses on. So we knew we needed her to help us understand some of that. Nori Allen is a very, you should have her talk to you sometime. She's a wonderful researcher who thinks about cardiovascular health in the population and has access to hundreds of thousands of medical records across Chicagoland looking at the cardiovascular health of kids. So she clearly needed to be part of the team. Linda Van Horn, one of our senior faculty, a dietitian who has actually led the US DA dietary recommendations, you know, the food pyramid, all that. She intervenes on moms and kids early in life, during pregnancy and early in life, to try to prevent pediatric obesity. We knew she had to be part of the team. Lifeng Hao is a basic scientist who studies DNA, but not genes. What she studies is probably more important. So we inherit the DNA code, the sequence, right? Four base pairs, sequence, that's what makes up your DNA. Tens of thousands of genes. We spent $100 million sequencing the first human being's genome. Now we spend about $1,000 doing it. Throw it away. Unless you have a rare disease where one change in your DNA causes that disease, the things that we really worry about on the population level, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, those are caused by multiple changes across the genome, and it's not usually the change in a base pair in your DNA. It's stuff that happens to your DNA after you're formed, right? So it's not so much what the sequence of your DNA is, it's whether you express that gene and how often you express that gene and whether you can express it in the setting of an infection or some other challenge from the environment. So this is called epigenetics. So as we go through life and are exposed to different dietary patterns, different environmental toxins, we change our DNA. We don't change the code, But we put little things on the DNA that determine whether we can express that gene or not, or how well we can express that gene. And it turns out that's much more important than the code sequence when you're talking about chronic diseases. So Li Fang is a world expert in epigenetics, studying the markers on the DNA, not the code sequence, but how well we can express those genes. Because we know, always hard to say this to a room full of women, what happens to you in utero, what you're exposed to in utero, famine, excess calories, yes, cigarette smoking, maybe alcohol, starts to program what genes the baby can express from the first moment of life, after birth. Sorry, moms, but it turns out to be true. It's not so much you are what you eat, although that's really important too. You are what your mom ate, and you are what your grandmother ate, because this passes transgenerationally, mostly through, not entirely, but mostly through the female lineage. So this is incredibly important stuff. We have to understand how the epigenetics are changing in utero and early in life if we want to understand how we can maintain cardiovascular health. So we've got Matt Davis, who's a wonderful pediatrician who's going to train the next generation of scientists. So we've got a basic scientist thinking about changes in DNA. We've got a clinical trialist who wants to intervene on moms and young kids to change their diet. We've got a population scientist working with a lot of data. And we've got a neuropsychologist, right? How do you get these people to talk to each other? Well, the answer is, again, you find that common vocabulary, you bang your heads together, and we knew we had a good story and an important question we had to answer, and it worked. So I'm going to walk you briefly through what we did, and I think I've kind of covered this. This was our problem. How do we figure out how to measure this neurodevelopmental aspect? Because we know it's got to be important, that this early development changes behavior, increases disinhibition, stressful environments play a role, and ultimately you've got this adolescent who perhaps is less good at discipline about their health behaviors. So how are we going from here to here through psychology and neurodevelopment? It's really hard, but I think we found a very good story to tell, and we did it through three different studies. A population science study led by Nori, understanding the status and the trajectories of cardiovascular health, and how we can measure and monitor it so we can scale this to the population. Again, in clinicians' offices, not having to measure anything special. Linda's project, can we intervene to preserve cardiovascular health in early life with dietary interventions? And how can we understand the maternal-fetal environment to get kids off to a better start? And then Li Fang's project of understanding the molecular pathways that are involved through epigenetics that lead to loss or preservation of cardiovascular health. And then understanding, again, this kind of neurodevelopmental health and the child's social environment, how they modify those CVH trajectories. So I want to leave time for questions, so I'm going to zoom ahead because I think you get the idea. But this is the key thing. This is what successful interdisciplinary collaborative science looks like. We had to find a way to make sure that all three of these projects talked to each other in a meaningful way. Otherwise, they would just be silos. We would answer an interesting question, and there it would sit. So this was really the key, conceptually for us, of making our collaborative team work, is what's the interaction between the population science project and the basic science project? Well, Nori will define the trajectories of cardiovascular health, and then she will turn over blood samples from the kids where we've defined their cardiovascular health trajectory, and we know we have blood, actually, we have cord blood, so from the placenta at birth, we have early life blood in these kids because we followed for a while, and we have blood from them when they're age 3 to 5 and age 8. So we'll be able to look at how their epigenetics have changed from the moment of birth through age 8. So important collaboration, because she'll tell us what their trajectories are, and then Li Fang will tell us what are the markers, what are the epigenetic things that have changed associated with that trajectory. Again, Li Fang's measuring that. She's going to learn a lot about where the hotspots are in the epigenome as she does that. Linda, meanwhile, has this wonderful study where she took moms who were already obese at conception and did a dietary intervention to try to limit weight gain during pregnancy and looked at birth outcomes. Again, she collected blood from the moms and the babies through that trial. Now those kids are 3 to 5 years of age, and she is going to do another intervention. So half the moms got an intervention to limit weight. Half the moms got information, but not the intensive intervention. Now she's going to re-randomize those groups so that the kids now get an intervention to try to limit kid weight gain. So we're going to learn an awful lot from this study. And knowing what the hotspots are, Lifang can now go look and see whether these interventions are making a difference in that epigenome. Because if we can find the targets, the hotspots in the genome, that's a target for drug delivery ultimately. If we can prevent the epigenetics from changing into adverse ways and turning off genes that we don't want turned off. So this, again, was really the key. And then those modifiers, the neurodevelopment and things, really are the key between the population and clinical science. So that's collaboration in action. Again, we had 2 weeks to pull all this together. I'm going to zoom ahead. We had lots of support from the institutions. Again, it's bad when your bosses talk, so we'll just zip through all this stuff. But we'll make the slides available to you. And I want to get to this. So we submitted it in January. By May, we got our score back. It was the highest score of all 23 applications, I'm proud to say. Brad did an amazing job, and our three science leaders, Nori, Linda, and Lifang, were just outstanding in making all of this go. We had to go down to Dallas to present our vision to the American Heart Association together, and the comments we got back were, it was like you guys could finish each other's sentences. That made us feel, you know, incredibly good because we had put the time in. And I've seen some of the other presentations from the other teams, and they had amazing science that wasn't talking to each other across the projects. And that was really the key, I think, to why we were very excited about this and why AHA was excited about it. We've been funded since July. The three other centers are at Duke now, University of Utah and DC Children's Hospital. Duke is focusing on childhood obesity, so we've already developed new projects that would never have happened unless we had been part of this network. These two are really focusing on congenital heart disease, another obviously incredibly important mission-critical area for American Heart Association. And just to kind of visit these things, these were, you know, things that conceptually we all know in engaging in team science, but I think it could not have been more true in how this particular center played out. So I will stop there. We should have good time for questions, and thank you so much for your attention.
This is fantastic. It's really, really fantastic. And so what I'm hearing from this is we need a self-love program for mothers, that really the most important factor in this is good mothering. And the fundamentals of that are very simple. I guess my question is, how willing is Northwestern to look at alternative physicians like Darren Weissman, who was from Chicago, who now lives in California, who developed the seven pillars of health, which is rest, hydration, nutrition, exercise, and personal choice. Personal choice is empowerment, so you avoid stress. So these are very simple, and if we had a program where we educated pregnant women and mothers on how what is the value of living healthy, what would that look like? And how willing are you to look at Deepak Chopra's work, Dean Ornish, Darren Weissman, et cetera?
So
can I take one quick crack?
Yes, please.
So I'll take one quick crack before, because he's the preventative guy. I'm the something bad happens guy. that's when mothers or anyone can kind of control their own environment, then their self-behavior is really the primary determinant potentially of the outcome. Unfortunately, there's folks that find themselves in situations where an environmental adverse event happens to them, and how do we modify that? So I wanted to go first because we have a program. When Mr. Magoon mentioned one of our three areas of emphasis in our Center of Excellence is called the perinatal origins of disease. This is a classic example of one of the areas of target in terms of the perinatal origins of disease for cardiovascular health. We have another program working with Lori as well and other folks at Evanston, again, completely transdisciplinary science collaboration, where moms in Chicago who are subject to environmental adverse events, so pregnant moms who are maybe victims of abuse, maybe witnesses to violence, and are pregnant. We actually are working with John Rogers, so they are wearing Bluetooth-enabled sensors, and we get the information from them saying something's not right. Their heart rate's up. They must be stressed out. Half their group gets an intervention that Lori and her team have already looked at in terms of getting moms to relax and wellness, and the other group is randomized to nothing to see if, when uncontrollable bad things happen to a mom, can we actually modify that? Can we understand how to monitor it, intervene, and measure the outcome in the kids? So sometimes we have self-control and prevention by behavior. Sometimes environmental stuff happens to us. And so those are the kinds of processes that are also developing here as well through the collaborations. I don't know if you have other thoughts.
Yeah, I would build on that. I mean, I think that the areas, it's funny, you know, there are seven metrics of cardiovascular health. AHA has branded those as Life's Simple Seven. And if you want to check your own cardiovascular health, that's the thing to Google, is Life's Simple Seven. But there's Life's Simple Seven. Life's Simple Seven. Yeah. It's amazing how much overlap there was between the list that you had and what's up there, isn't there? I think that this is an incredibly important area of medicine right now, is understanding the interface between mindfulness, healthy behaviors, and traditional Western medicine. We don't do it well anywhere. We have a Center for Integrative Health here, which actually does incorporate many of the concepts that have been put out by people like Deepak Chopra and others that really try to, again, I think it's aptly named, integrate more than just traditional osteopathic Western medicine approaches to this. But we also have to create a healthier society, right? We have to create a culture of health, because it's great to talk about this, but if you can't actually buy fruits and vegetables, and even if you have access to fruits and vegetables, you don't know how to cook them, or it's not safe to go out and be physically active after dinner because you live on the South Side. This is the problem, I think, for this century, for this country, is we have to put health in every single policy at every level of government so that we tilt that playing field where the default choice is the healthy choice, because we can't afford the tsunami of bad health that's coming as a result of the obesity epidemic. We have to turn the curve 15 years ago, and so now it's even more imperative. But so that has a huge role, no doubt about it, and we have to learn how to empower people to control their environment, be mindful, and not participate in some of those unhealthy behaviors. But we have to, again, we have to tilt the playing field so it's possible as well. So this is a multi-level, multi-scale, complex problem. But I love the thinking, because, you know, as a traditionally trained doctor, we don't get enough of that. We truly don't.
And one last point, since we have our two medical school education leaders in the room. You know, this is a stressful profession as well, so we have to also be thinking about ourselves and maintaining wellness. It's something built in to both the undergraduate and graduate medical education, evolving in terms of wellness for ourselves, and then if you know that, you know how to do that for your patients as well. So it's part of our vision and Eric's vision in the curriculum.
Thank you for this wonderful presentation. One question I have is, there have been studies that shown fetal blood, cord blood, has many, many, many persistent chemicals in it on the day of a child's birth. I haven't heard anything about, in this whole presentation, about toxins in the environment and how much they're altering the health care of all of us. And is there any plan to have some sort of public policy pressure to limit the chemicals in our environment?
I unfortunately, in this day and age, I think it's really difficult to talk about national policy. And I'm not going to be political here. I'm not going to be political here, but clearly we have a major challenge with leadership. And it's not, when you think about environmental health and public health, You know, for example, having come from Ann Arbor 2 years ago, Flint didn't happen under the current administration. So it does reflect, and Eric commented on this a little bit, talking about the vision of Northwestern moving the Institute for Public Health and Medicine within the medical school as opposed to a siloed separate school, because public health has really been a lost investment of the country. So we have to acknowledge that in terms of the challenges that we have by policy. The other component of environmental health is the ongoing narrative regarding, you know, fake news. I mean, so who's telling the truth regarding the environmental toxins? So you, on some hand, you have the I'm from Detroit, you know, I was in Ann Arbor. The big three arguing that certain measurements of environmental pollutions should have been at one level, and scientists arguing that no, there may be effects at other levels. So you think about the complexity of that debate in terms of focusing on what we know about the environmental effect on health, and whatever one you, whether you want to pick an adult who has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, an adolescent who has asthma, or a fetus who's developing and a mom who's being exposed to these things. So again, focusing, we do have a component within the perinatal origins of disease that actually collects and compares cord blood and what's called genomics is the genes, and we have metabolomics, which are the metabolites or the toxins, environmental aspects of it, that are looking at various components of it, not all globally, so you have to have somewhat of a focus. So it's a complex challenge. We would hope that there is a National Institute for Environmental Health Science hasn't quite been as aggressive in trying to understand the impact early on in development, because the NIH institutes, no offense, always have a little bit of a focus on adults and forget that everything, they're starting to understand this, how important it is that everything that happens in the fetal environment may set your trajectory from ongoing standpoints. And it's important because what Don elucidated regarding this concept of epigenetics, right? We do know that what happens with certain toxins, these marks, they're called methylation marks on top of the DNA, the machinery to turn on anti-cancer genes that are being made right now in us, they start to turn off. And when you lose that protection, now you lose your cancer protection, and that's why environmental problems are often the cause of cancer, because we've turned a key gene off. So we could modify that. If we understood it better, we could actually intervene and modify that. So I'm hoping that the complexity of it can be addressed, and it's going to require the kind of collaborations of examples that you've heard of today.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I think metabolomics is going to be an important key to this. It's a brand new field of investigation. We are just scratching the surface and understanding what is circulating in our bodies and our babies' bodies. a couple quick examples. The material that's in, that lines our frying pans, our non-stick materials, you have massive amounts of that in your bloodstream right now, and it doesn't degrade. It's just floating around there. We have no idea what that's doing to you, but it's there. Great study that I was able to comment on last.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Exactly. Just don't use a non-stick pan, right? Great story. You guys have heard of BPA, right? So it's a really elegantly done study, just in 60 people, but it showed, I think, something profound. They took liquid, in this case it was milk, that was stored in a container lined with BPA and one that was not. They poured it into a separate vessel, and they gave it to half of their study participants, and then they gave the non-BPA lined same milk to the other half of people. Within 30 minutes, there were massive amounts of BPA in the urine. So, you know, there was no BPA at baseline. Didn't get there any other way than through the milk that was drunk, that got absorbed by the gut, traveled through the bloodstream, got filtered by the kidneys, and came out in the urine. So it passed through their bodies, no doubt about it. What they were interested in was, does BPA affect blood pressure? And in the people who'd been exposed to BPA, and by the way, then the next day they switched it up, so everybody ultimately got exposed to not BPA or BPA-containing milk. The people who got the BPA-containing milk again, 30 minutes later, had blood pressure levels 6 points higher than the people who didn't get BPA. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot for an individual. You translate that to a group or a population, that's a 50% increased risk in stroke, if maintained over time. So the environment is killing us. We just don't know how yet. And again, metabolomics is going to be a really crucial way for us to understand what we need to pull out of our food supply, out of our air, and many other things. So there's a question back here. I've been waiting for a while. Oh, sure.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to preempt you. I just happened to be closer. You've collaborated on this talk, and it's very impressive because you not only spoke about your intent, you spoke about it pre-birth, post-birth, and you've talked about the markers for affecting it. And one of them was to learn a common vocabulary so the team can collaborate with you. What does that mean? And I had to ask a different question now.
So maybe the best example I can give you, I'm trying to think of the word. We discovered about a week into the process of putting that center grant together that we were all using a common word, and I can't remember what it was, but each of us, our basic scientist, our population scientist, our clinical scientist, Brad, and myself, coming from our different backgrounds, we were all using the same word, and we knew exactly what it meant, and none of us was using it in the same way. So we literally had to go around the table and say, how are you defining that? And say, wow, that doesn't even enter my world as a definition for that word. And I wish I could think of what it was, because it would be more powerful. But literally, one word was holding us up because we weren't understanding it the same way. And once we did that, and we also then kind of got a common glossary of terms together, that was when we made our breakthroughs.
So the other point is the one that I just heard Dr. Shanley reference. I heard you reference, Don. And that was potentially, the question really posed was, how can you help people become more preventative towards a healthier life? And I think your power is so enormous. I cannot begin to tell you. Having sat on the National Council on Disability for 9 years in the 90s, I can tell you I had to understand the power of public health because, frankly, I might have been a public health nurse, my mother, but I didn't really understand it. And I see it. It was a kind of a weak law. And it took until the 2000s before people started to really seriously, besides public buildings, even today in Chicago, there are restaurants that get exempted. But it was the goodwill of the people that affected the Americans with Disability Act. And I bring this up to you because I think your power may be greater in this area than you realize. If you were to put in somebody on mindfulness or whatever it is, at the medical school model, teach it as APA, American Academy of Pediatric courses, et cetera. I mean, I really want to point this out because until your doctor sometimes reminds you, you don't do it to yourself. Because we're a hard work ethic in our country and we pride ourselves on it at all levels. And that's one. Two, I'd spend money on the website. I'd spend on the money on the website and on social marketing and just get there's a public image for Lurie, there's one for Northwestern Medicine, whatever it is, and get that marker talking about your health tip for today is, are you taking time to set aside time for quiet time for yourself? I mean, frankly, our stress levels, we see this in our clinic. Oh my gosh, 200 children twice weekly, and the biggest issue today is the anxiety of the children. These are babies. These are 2 years, 4 years. They aren't motor needs. They aren't sensory needs. It affects their sensory, and it's the stress. I think you'd have a remarkable leadership role that you don't even realize.
I appreciate those comments, Shirley. I would add one last piece, which I think is really critical, is that so much of our behavior in the U.S., like it or not, is really financially motivated. And like, say what you will about the Affordable Care Act, the one concept about the ACA was that we're going to go broke as a country if we continue the current health model, the health system model we have. And until we start to say, we're going to give you this much money to manage a population. And the only way to make that model successful is by making that population as healthy as you can through preventative strategies. Until that structure gets put into place, right now, I mean, I get paid to do more stuff when people get sick. And that's just that fee-for-service concept. We've got to change that. We have to change the way industries are, what they are charged in terms of insurance cost, and make it more incentive and beneficial to be healthy when you're covered under those entities. It's just sort of the nature of the U.S. that behavior is often so often driven by financial incentivization, and they're completely misaligned to that concept of preventative medicine these days. And I think that's where the policy changes could really impact on where we go directionally.
It seems that we hear more and more about childhood-defined cancers expressing themselves in adults, and that adults receiving childhood protocol. What is that? Is that a cancer that's not expressed until later because people are taking better care of themselves, or is this a new phenomenon?
Childhood cancers coming out in adulthood.
Well, I'm not entirely sure. We have increasing improvements in terms of health outcomes for moving some of the kids with childhood diseases into adulthood. Again, I think with the various environmental influences that people are getting exposed to in their mid or later lives, it may have something to do in terms of their ability to either fight off or their risk of developing a cancer from that standpoint. That's not something that we've been thinking as much about as we maybe should. You always worry about epidemiologic clusters of things, that there's something environmentally that we're missing.
Hi. Pat Magoon mentioned in his brief comments that investment early on in a child's life could serve as a good investment long term for financiers, including government. I'm wondering, and that a lot is about making the case for collaboration, the smart work that various people bring together on a problem and focus. Do you know of any instances where this kind of collaboration has resulted in hard enough data that government has said, you're right, we'll pay now, because we know in terms of the long-term arc, this is going to be less expensive, people will be healthier. Has anyone been successful enough to make that case to government?
Well, fundamentally, at the end of the day, vaccination is one strategy. I mean, vaccines to various things have been developed over the decades, and they're paid for by many governmental agencies for folks that can't pay for them because of the preventative nature of what they provide, instead of expense that would be associated with a bout of severe meningitis. So for me, one of the most transformative experiences in my own personal career as an intensive care doc, when I started training, we had kids that came in incredibly sick and would be incredibly devastated by Haemophilus influenza pneumonia. With the HIV vaccine against it, I have fellows who've never seen it now. So there are some of those examples where people have said clearly investments into programs where preventative aspects of it should be paid for, supported, and be policy. I think when you start to, when you start to think about a cardiovascular, I mean, who wouldn't go to Capitol Hill or the White House today after Don's talk and say, guys, we got this all screwed up. I mean, look at what we can do in terms of preventative cardiovascular health. What a huge cost savings this process would be. So, yeah, I mean, I would say, there's a great example where the science He wasn't making that stuff up. That's the science that the epidemiologists have done that tells us exactly what we could do to save tons of money from that standpoint. And I do think when I mentioned sort of the perinatal origins of disease program, this concept of how we might be able to prevent the adverse events or reverse the consequences of adverse events is really an attempt in large part to prevent premature delivery. And obviously, you know, the expenses of premature births and the neonatal intensive care unit expenses and long-term consequences that can derive from intravenous bleeding in the heads, from retinopathy challenges with kids that are born, those are extraordinary lifelong costs. So again, I don't know that our country policymakers have been that foresightful to know when the data driving the preventative strategy should make us create the expectations of the delivery and the policies. So,
just to put some numbers to that, within the last year, we were able to look at the costs of an individual during their Medicare lifespan, because we linked up some of the data I showed you to Medicare claims data. So we were able to look at that ideal cardiovascular health individual at age 50, and then follow them from age 65 forward, most of them till death, and calculate how much money we spent on them based on what they looked like at age 50 during their Medicare lifespan from 65 on. Because we were really interested in, you know, these people who get to 50 with ideal cardiovascular health, we know they're going to live longer. And the policymakers always say, if they're going to live longer, we're going to spend a lot more money on them. Guess what? Those people with ideal cardiovascular health, compared to everybody else who didn't have ideal cardiovascular health at age 50, from 65 on, we spent $75,000 less total during their Medicare lifespan for the ideal cardiovascular health people back here at age 50 compared to the whole rest of the group. Now, again, $75,000, not a big chunk of change, but when you put that at a population level, you start to talk about billions of dollars. And that's got some real potential and some legs. So we went to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, said, this is pretty good, right? What do you think? And they said, we love it. We would love to do it, but our enabling legislation from Congress does not allow us to pay for research on anyone younger than age 65 unless they're on dialysis. And there it is. Medicare would love to sink their teeth into earlier life prevention because they understand, and our data showed it, and they have other examples, that they could save an awful lot of money, but they're not physically not allowed to put money into research in earlier life.
See, personally, I would think Don Lloyd-Jones should run for senator.
Thank you. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Not right now. I think we're going to stop collaborating if you're going to wish for that.
Dr. Lloyd-Jones, you touched on it briefly, and then you kind of jumped off on it. Doesn't it ultimately come down, certainly with epigenetics and early cardiovascular health, to economics in terms of a liter of Coke is 60% cheaper than a gallon of milk? The McDonald's dollar value meal is a whole lot easier to feed your family if you're on a restricted income or public assistance.
Yeah.
While it would be great if everybody ate fresh vegetables and stuff, they're just ultimately not affordable. And don't we look in Chicago, more money has been spent on this anti-sugar tax campaign than public education campaigns.
Yep.
And we're addicted to sugar, and maybe not out of necessity, but out of economics.
Yeah, it's really true. And your larger point, socioeconomic status is the main problem with health in this country, because it drives everything, whether we can have healthy behaviors, whether we have access to preventive care. Socioeconomic status, if we could fix that, we would go an awfully long way to fixing health.
Yeah, and I will only add, hopefully Marianne and I were having a conversation before we started. These are complex problems, and when you look at them in aggregate, like the Chicagoland area, it's overwhelming. It's also hard to measure impact. So Lurie Children's Healthy Communities, and maybe an opportunity to have Matt or somebody from LCHC come and speak with you all, our strategy is going to be neighborhood targeted. So we're a predominantly African-American neighborhood and a predominantly Latino neighborhood with very bad health disparities, and dive in with the community partnerships to begin to understand the multiple factors. There's so many covariants that affect and impact the health of that community, both the pediatric and adults. And so that will give us, we hope, a laboratory to be able to demonstrate specific implementations and effectiveness. That scaling it is still going to be a complex challenge, most likely, but at least it starts to get us into a manageable context that hopefully the, and again, you think about the collaborative nature of what we're needed to do, that kind of work, hopefully we'll get some answers out of that over the years. That's, and it's going to take years to understand fully.
You touched on something near and dear to my heart, which was the sugar tax. So I spent many hours talking to our county board commissioners, because I do a lot of volunteering for the American Heart Association, and this was priority one for the Heart Association. We know it works. We know it works, and it hits exactly the target population that we want to hit, kids with not much extra change in their pockets. unfortunately, the regulatory environment in Cook County and Illinois kind of tilted the, stacked the deck against this working. But this fight is not over. And we just look at what's happened to tobacco consumption in this country as we've implemented tobacco taxes. These are choice taxes. I get it, tax is a dirty word, but it actually works. To see the millions of dollars that Big Soda spent, because they understood this was a beachhead and they had to knock it back. This was the largest population covered to date by a sugar tax. And they knew they had to be, but they spent, we don't even know how much, but it was multiple tens of millions of dollars to beat this back. And we went from a 9-8 vote on the county board to 15-1 against when they repealed it. Because money talks in politics, right? But this is not over. I mean, we have other beachheads around the country. There are places where the regulatory environment is more favorable for such legislation. And I think we will reach a tipping point just as we did with tobacco, where we don't have a choice. This is the only way. And you can kind of see the industry moving there ahead of us, right? You've seen the Coke ads, right? Where they're actually starting to emphasize their non-sugar sweetened beverages. They make more money on water than they make on Coke. So it only makes sense for them to make the change also. But they haven't been there yet. And I think, you know, one way or another, we have to keep pushing because it's the right thing to do. And it's about health. It's not about revenue. It's about health. And unfortunately, I think the conversation got changed a little bit as this played out.
Yeah, with so many civic leaders in the room, the quicker we can depoliticize health, the farther this country will go.
Yeah.
Thank you for this wonderful presentation. You've certainly given us a lot to think about. I wonder, when you talked about you are what your mother eats, is the American Heart Association working with obstetricians to get them to really zero in on this with their patients?
Yeah, so the answer is yes. There are politics in professional societies as well. But actually, ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, is one of the people who will come to the table. We've had trouble with the internists because the truth is, if we get mom and dad healthier before conception, it's even better than starting after conception at that first, well mom visit. So it's an ongoing fight, but I think, data talks, and it will convince them to get to the table as well. There's just too much we have to do here not to.
Is it an option to collaborate with a healthy food provider like Whole Foods or something like that?
Absolutely, and AHA does a lot of that work. the one of the best public health initiatives that I saw in the last 5 years was, amazingly enough, Walmart. With a visionary CEO said, we understand there is way too much sodium in the food supply. Walmart, number one grocer in the world. A little bit surprising to hear that, right? But they are the number one grocer in the world. So they said, we make all these Walmart brands, and over the next 5 years, we're going to reduce the sodium content of Walmart-branded products by 25%, and we think they've done it. And Kraft, Unilever, whoever else, if you want to be on our shelves, you have to do the same thing. That is vision, I think. And that's how we move the needle in partnership. And AHA has been helping them with that initiative. Getting CVS to take the leap and pull tobacco from their stores, that wasn't easy. That's real revenue. But, then you kind of push back and say, let's get people in the stores for other reasons, and let's help you do that. I mean, that's the kind of corporate responsibility that I think we should be rewarding and championing, because it really works.
Thank you for this amazing information. So earlier you mentioned that BHA is in like milk bottles and water bottles, so that's the plastic. So what is the safest way to drink water?
Well, so first, drinking water is an incredibly good choice, right? generally speaking, you can find BPA-free containers now. I think BPA will start to go away for not just the study I mentioned, but other reasons. Excuse me. Assuming there's no lead in the pipes, municipal water supplies, other than places like Flint local lead pipes, are actually, I mean, that's honestly, that's a big reason why we now live to 87 instead of 47, is we have healthy water, right? I mean, that probably, through the first half of the 20th century, contributed more than any single thing to the expanding lifespan, was the reductions in acute infections because of healthy water supplies. So drink that tap water. If you need a Brita filter, great, whatever, you know. But generally, municipal water supplies in this country are a great source of a healthy drink.
And I was encouraged to drink out of a 2,200-year-old aquifer in Italy a couple weeks ago, so I'm probably not the right person to ask.
Tough life.
I came back okay, though.
It'll be the last question. Thank you very much. Thank you. Food stamps interest me. Do they designate that the person should be buying milk and eggs and fresh vegetables when they use their food stamps?
I don't know that for sure. I know historically there weren't regulations on what was purchased in grocery stores and other markets. I think that may have changed slightly, but I have to admit I don't know.
It's changed slightly. There's not what you would hope there would be in terms of what SNAP will cover, food stamps will cover, but we have a long way to go there for sure. We've kind of been skirting around this issue of behavioral economics. Incentivizing healthy behaviors and healthy choices is an incredibly important way to move the needle here. So I think that's one strategy that needs to be kind of pushed, but it's certainly not the only one, because, of course, you want to be equitable, right, in incentivizing healthy choices, for sure. Great.
Well, thank you.
That's fun.
Okay, well, thanks very much to our presenters. Tom, did you know Don when you signed on at NU? Had you guys met? Yeah. Oh, yeah? Oh, my gosh, yeah. So this is an old friendship. It's not a new friendship. All right, well, thank you for highlighting this great collaboration across the age span, from youth to adulthood. Next week is our last week. We're going to have Chad Merkin come from Department of Chemistry and Nanotechnology and bring one of his collaborators from engineering to talk about cancer therapies and some of their latest research, which should be really exciting. So thanks very much, and see you next week. Shirley would like to say something.
Just one second. I want to thank you. You are the best class, but also you can see we are very, very fortunate to have men, gentlemen, people, leaders who are such good people, really driven by the appropriate, finding the best way to help cause. And I'm very grateful. We are very grateful to you both. And just to show the collaborative model that we've had, Morty began it with Morty Shapiro, with Saul Morrison, his dear friend, an economist and a humanist. And they pointed out, in fact, the Nobel Prize was given for it 4 days later, that behavioral economics, it's not straight and it's not linear alone. You can draw your mathematical equations, you have to put in the human model. you deal with the human model, and it's very complicated, and we appreciate your work. And you even referenced John Rogers, who we enjoyed so much at the hospital. At the hospital called the Shirley Ranability Lab. I have a real problem saying it, as Lydia knows. I'm not faking it. And the reality is, John was wonderful. Comes out of what he works with so tightly is Chad Merkin, our last speaker next week. And Chad really is distinguished in the world for his work on nanotechnology. He is the one that at 1/1000th, the head of a pin, He has created and worked with the models and created the scientists all over the world who are promoting separating molecules. This is part of this work that we're talking about today, and we thank you. Thank you for collaborating with us.